Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. A year since the COVID-19 pandemic began in the United States, most of the talk is about vaccines and how and where to get a vaccination against the virus. What the vaccines have done is give people hope that fewer people will get sick and die, and that life may return to what it looked like before the pandemic, if that is possible. In that year, we've hosted medical professionals, researchers, and scientists to answer questions about the virus. And to this day, we still have many questions about the virus and the vaccines. Today, we host another question and answer session with Dr. Eugene Curley, an infectious disease specialist at WellSpan Health. Dr. Curley, good to see you again.
Good morning, and thanks for having me again.
If you have a question or a comment about the virus, about the pandemic, there's nothing that, you can't ask. This is your opportunity. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Curley, CDC and Pennsylvania have relaxed some mitigation rules. Cases are down since January, but just in the last week, they have begun to rise again. 25 counties have substantial spread, according to the Department of Health, and they include Berks, Franklin, Lancaster, Lebanon, Montour, Northumberland, and York in our area. There's now a 6.5% positivity rate. It still feels like there's light at the end of the tunnel. But that rise in cases is concerning, and it kind of has that feel of, here we go again. What about this rise over the past week?
Yeah, so this is an extremely critical time period. And mainly because there are a couple different factors. You know, the weather is warming up, so people are going to naturally start venturing outside. I watched some of the events, people going out to bars during St. Patrick's Day, and this past weekend I was watching some of the events of spring break. So the reason why it's so critical is because not enough people have been vaccinated to date. You know, we're still having some supply issues. There's estimated that those supply issues should be resolved by May. So, once I kind of heard about the safety protocols being relaxed, I mean, I've really been in fear that we may see another surge over the next month or so. So we'll have to wait and see, and hopefully we don't get there. But I really wish that we would have waited to relax some of these restrictions until a significant portion of the population was vaccinated.
That's not what people want to hear, obviously. But when you say a significant portion of the population, any idea what you mean, percentages, just what?
Yeah, we still don't know. So what you're asking about is that magical herd immunity number. We've heard estimates as low as 60%, and we've seen estimates as high as 95%. The reality is we're probably not going to know what that number is until we hit it. So when a significant portion of the population is vaccinated, and we are seeing extremely low virus activity in the community, I think that's when we'll have a better idea of what that magic number is. But I can tell you we're nowhere close. As of this morning, it only looks that 13.3% of the entire U.S. population has been fully vaccinated. Approximately 24.5% of the U.S. population has received at least one dose. So we still have a ways to go.
When you're saying herd immunity, and it does make sense when you say we probably won't know until we're there, but when you're talking about percentages and achieving herd immunity, are you talking about two vaccinations from Moderna or Pfizer for 60% of the people, or just one?
Just based on the data we have from the clinical trials, we have to rely on two-dose vaccination for both Pfizer and Moderna and the one dose for Johnson & Johnson.
So 60% everyone fully vaccinated, or 60% fully vaccinated before getting to herd immunity. I saw a figure this morning that caught my eye. 44% of people in Pennsylvania who are 65 and older have gotten at least one shot. I think it makes sense when you talk about supply, but it seems like it's taken so long for this vulnerable population to get their shots when that group was the priority with getting shots. So 44% of 65 and older, I was a little surprised that it was that low.
Yeah, so we have to remember with the vaccine allocation rollout, it was initially prioritized to residents of long-term care facilities and healthcare workers. So that number is a lot higher in people that are older than 65 and are residents of long-term care facilities such as nursing homes. So those numbers are great, and that's the population that's probably highest at risk. We later saw that all individuals over the age of 65 and individuals ages 16 to 64 with medical conditions were added to that phase one allocation later. So naturally, it's going to take a little bit more time for all of those individuals to get vaccinated.
If you're just tuning in, Dr. Eugene Curley, an infectious disease specialist at WellSpan Health, is answering your coronavirus questions about the vaccine, really questions about anything. I have to say that it still surprises me a bit that a year into this, there are so many questions, and that's because things have changed. We've learned so much about this virus, about vaccines over the past year. 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call. If you would like to send an email, you can do that by sending it to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. We have a call that has been recorded from a listener, and let's go to that one right now, Jim.
Hi, my name is John, and I have a question about the COVID vaccine. I'm 49 years old. I've never had the flu shot, and I'm planning on getting the vaccine, and I'm wondering, because I've never had the flu shot in my life, if that potentially would affect anything.
Thank you for your call, John. Dr. Curley, what about that?
Yeah, good question, John. So the fact that you have never received the flu shot should not bear any weight on you receiving the COVID-19 vaccine. So I'm actually happy to hear that since you haven't been vaccinated with the flu, that you're very interested in getting the COVID-19 vaccine, which we are recommending for all people that are eligible to get it as soon as they can. But there should not be any circumstances or adverse events or effects that he should need to worry about.
Dr. Curley, I've heard several people say that they have had reactions to the flu shot, or it wasn't a pleasant experience for them, they got sick or whatever, and as a result, they are not going to get the COVID shot. Is there a relationship if someone has had a reaction to a flu shot or maybe some other shots they've gotten over the years? Does that mean they are susceptible to maybe some side effects from the COVID vaccination?
Yeah, currently there's no evidence of that. So the CDC recommends that if you've had any reaction, whether an allergic reaction or an adverse side effect from, let's say, a different vaccine such as the flu shot, you can still safely get the COVID-19 vaccine. The only contraindication to getting a COVID-19 vaccine is if you've had a severe allergic reaction from a previous dose of a COVID-19 vaccines. Other vaccines do not play a role there.
Wanted to bring this up, Dr. Curley. Kent Taylor, the founder and CEO of the Texas Roadhouse steakhouse chain, died by suicide last week. He had been diagnosed with COVID, but had post-COVID symptoms, especially tinnitus. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly or not, ringing in the ears. Is this common?
Yeah, so we're still learning a lot about post-COVID complications, and there are too numerous to count that we've heard about or reported. We'll definitely learn more about it. I'm not surprised to hear that tinnitus is a potential post-COVID complication. That is something that is sometimes affected by our central nervous system. So we've seen a ton of central nervous system post-COVID complications, things like stroke, things like memory loss. So not surprising to hear about tinnitus, but we're still learning a lot. And it doesn't seem to be specific to any one area of the body. I mean, there are cardiac, there are pulmonary post-COVID complications. We're even seeing dermatologic post-COVID complications, people developing various rashes after developing COVID. So it's still an emerging topic.
Ringing in the ears. I hate to say it, but when it's described that way, it sounds like it's not that painful, maybe not painful at all, that just would be a bothersome thing. But, I mean, it was severe enough that Mr. Taylor took his own life. I mean, is that a serious condition? And from what I understand, there are not a lot of treatment options for that.
Yeah, not that I'm aware of. And, I'm not an ear, nose, and throat doctor. I do see in my line of work a fair amount of patients with tinnitus. And the patients I've seen, they haven't been severe cases. But again, I'm not a specialist in that arena. And it'd be difficult to speculate on that gentleman's specific condition.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's take a phone call from Debbie in Pine Grove. Debbie, you're on Smart Talk.
Yes, good morning. I'm in charge of a bus driving office, and a lot of my drivers are older people. And only about half of them have opted for the vaccine. And is there some way that I could possibly convince more of them to get vaccinated?
Debbie, that is a great question. Thank you very much for your call. Dr. Curley, this is a real challenge.
It is. And this is a big part of what I do on a day-to-day basis is to try to curb some of this vaccine hesitancy. The way I tend to address it, and there are a lot of different materials out there. I'll definitely point you to the CDC website, and there they have a frequently asked questions section about vaccines in general, and they have a specific section on vaccine hesitancy. So I would point you to the CDC website. But what I try to do when I'm faced with someone who is hesitant about getting the vaccine is, one, you want to definitely address their concerns. I mean, don't push it off as something political, or it's very important just to address their concerns and see what the actual issue is. Just me on my day-to-day basis talking to, I have many coworkers who have decided for whatever reason not to get the vaccine. The reasons differ greatly. So I think it's very important to if there's myths or misconceptions or falsehoods that are out there, just to be able to speak to that. Pull up some of the articles, pull up the data. I applaud these pharmaceutical companies because, you know, they've made all the data very transparent, and this is the data is easy. You could just go on Google and search, fact sheet for Pfizer vaccine or fact sheet for Moderna vaccine, and all the data is there. So, but it's very important to address these concerns. And even if you don't have a breakthrough, keep the dialogue and the conversation going. For anybody out there that's listening right now, you know, do your research online and keep dialogue up with your primary physician. And, you know, if you have questions, ask them to address them.
Debbie, I'm curious, what is their biggest objection?
I get everything from they don't trust the drug companies. There's not enough empirical data for them. I don't know.
So it's a kind of all over the
place.
A
little wackadoodle. It is all over the place.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, it's a big question, and you may not be able to convince everyone, but certainly try to if you can. Debbie, thank you very much for your call. You know, Dr. Curley, the point that you know, there are some myths, as you mentioned, but as you also mentioned, that even some of your coworkers who are medical professionals are hesitant to take it. And I would assume that a lot of it has to do with the amount of testing that has gone on and how quickly the vaccine came to be, when it's usually a minimum of like 5 years or so. Is that the biggest reason you're hearing from your coworkers, or what is the objection they have?
Yeah, it's a variety of things. Speaking to Debbie, you know, as you know, the issue with trust, I can speak to the FDA, and their vetting process is extremely rigorous. So, you know, the timeline for Pfizer reaching the FDA emergency use authorization was about 11 months. Between January and December of 2020. And the FDA, they had very specific restrictions. They wanted at least 2 to 3 months of follow-up data. The mRNA technology that we've heard about is a technology that allows for faster production time. So, these pharmaceuticals companies did not skip any steps. This mRNA technology has been studied for decades. So although it seems like they reached the emergency use authorization fast, we didn't skip it. No steps were skipped, and it still went through very rigorous vetting process. These clinical trials weren't done in a small number of patients. These were a large number of patients. The Pfizer clinical trial had over 44,000 participants. Both Moderna and Johnson & Johnson had about 30,000 individuals each. So we have a lot of data, and the results in terms of efficacy and safety were overwhelmingly positive. So those are some of the things that I point out when I'm talking to individuals about this vaccine hesitancy. One of the biggest things that I always point out is the risk of contracting COVID and potentially dying from COVID far outweigh the risk of any vaccine at this time. So that's a very important point. All three of these vaccines are 100% protective in preventing hospitalizations and deaths. So that's a very important point.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, we'll be producing a segment on the science of dreams. Always a fascinating topic. A lot of reports, anecdotally anyway, of people having more vivid dreams during the pandemic. And we'll be talking about that as well. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. Our guest today is Dr. Eugene Curley, infectious disease specialist at WellSpan Health, answering your coronavirus questions. 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call if you do have a question. You could send your question to smarttalk@witf.org. on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a phone call from Joshua in Lancaster. Joshua, you're on Smart Talk.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question has to do with how the body responds to a vaccine and its response system to coronavirus afterwards. So my understanding is that when you receive a vaccine, it's not like a bubble is put around you and this vaccine cannot penetrate, but it just helps your body's natural immune systems to respond faster, and then the coronavirus has less effect on your systems. So when things got started, you know, we looked at a 14-day quarantine period because of contagion that I think at some point was knocked down to 10 days. So I guess the heart of my question is, with a vaccine, is there still a time period of contagion that we should, you know, be considering? Like, is it down to 2 days? I'm thinking like the public school system that we would have to think about things like that.
Joshua, good question. Thank you very much. Dr. Curl, what about that?
The vaccine works is the vaccine has the genetic instructions for the spike protein of the coronavirus. And that spike protein from coronavirus is responsible for its ability to enter into our cells and cause us infection. So the vaccine will tell our cells to make a little bit of the spike protein, and our immune system will then recognize this spike protein as foreign and start to develop an immune response, make antibodies, so that if you're exposed to that spike protein again, let's say with true coronavirus, your immune system will recognize it up front, attack the coronavirus before it's able to get into your cells and cause you infection, okay? Now, the big question that you're hitting on is still unanswered, and that's after vaccination. So I've been vaccinated. Can I still transmit the virus? So let's say I go to the hospital today and I go into a patient's room that has coronavirus, and I just, for whatever reason, I would never do this, but let's say I decide not to wear a mask. Now, I've been vaccinated, so it's highly unlikely that I will get sick or contract coronavirus. However, when I come home to my wife and my child, can I transmit the virus to them because they have not been vaccinated? So that question is still unanswered. Experts are working on that. There is some early reports saying that the vaccine may be protective in virus transmission, but we don't know that answer yet. And that is the reason why we're still recommending that even after vaccination, that people should still follow safety protocols for now, wear a mask, wash your hands, and practice social distancing.
Okay, well, along those lines, one of the questions that many people have had, and this is related to Joshua's question as well, once someone is fully vaccinated, can they meet with people right away, or should they quarantine, or just this week, Pennsylvania has changed its rules to conform with CDC rules. What about that? How long should someone who's been fully vaccinated stay away from people, or can they meet with people right away?
Yeah, so those updated guidelines deal with fully vaccinated people potentially meeting up with other fully vaccinated people without social distancing and masks. So there is new guidance from the CDC on this topic. What I will warn everybody is that these guidelines are very detailed, and there are a lot of exceptions. I'll be honest with you, I had to read the guidelines 3 times before I had a good understanding of what's going on, because there are just so many caveats and exceptions to their rules. So I won't get into specifics, but there is evidence out there that fully vaccinated people may be able to meet up with fully vaccinated people without masks and social distancing at low risk. I want to make sure everyone understands that. They're not saying it's zero risk. They're saying it's low risk. And that's because, again, getting back to my previous point, we still don't know much about whether fully vaccinated people can transmit the virus.
Dr. Curley, question from Catherine says, in some countries, we have seen residents wearing masks for many years, long before the COVID-19 pandemic. Will mask wearing become a necessary norm in crowds for the long term? Is this part of being in a crowded world? And then she also says, at the same time, does mask wearing potentially create other health consequences? I feel as if my own allergies are worse since wearing a mask, which she says seems illogical.
Yeah, so what I can say to that is masks are definitely the new normal. I hope that at some point we'll be able to get rid of masks. But again, that is going to depend on how things go with the pandemic. So, you know, are we reaching herd immunity here in the United States? You know, even if we reach herd immunity in the United States, what is the rest of the world doing? We're hearing about these variants. How do these variants play a role? So again, if we get to the point where, you know, a significant portion of the world's population is vaccinated and there's extremely low circulating virus in the world, or maybe we even get lucky and are able to eradicate coronavirus, then I think masks will probably
go away. Hi, this is Lauren calling at from that point,
but again, it's the new normal for right now.
What about the allergies in wearing masks?
Yeah, so that's interesting because some of the people I talk to, even my son, he has really bad seasonal allergies and asthma, and it really hasn't plagued him at all during the pandemic because he's been wearing a mask. So it's difficult to speculate why her allergies have been acting up. Very difficult to say. I don't know if it's something within the mask that she could be potentially allergic to, but it seems that if you were wearing a mask, that it would help to protect against some of those allergens.
Another question, Dr. Curley, will the vaccine guard against all strains of COVID-19 or just the popular variant? And what is the likelihood that there will be other vaccines coming out for the other variances?
Yeah, so very good question. Another emerging topic that we're finally starting to get some answers on. So and we really learned a lot from the Johnson & Johnson clinical trials, because those trials were not only performed in the U.S., but a significant amount of the participants were from Brazil and South Africa, where some of those variants are. So currently, the most popular variant is the UK variant, and there are a little over, 6,000 reported cases now in the U.S. The South African variant, I think there are about 200 cases in the United States right now, and the Brazil variant, there's less than 100 cases, but experts are speculating that those are going to become the predominant variants across the United States. Now, the data we have right now shows that the UK variant is definitely more transmissible, but it seems that all three vaccines seem to protect against that very, very well. The vaccine efficacy seems to be less with both the South African variant and the variant from Brazil. So just to give you an estimation on numbers, I think the Johnson & Johnson was about 52% effective in South Africa, but it was about 72% effective here in the United States. And that's because we don't have a lot of those variants here in the United States. Now, the important thing I will point out, because this is just very important to know, that even if you contract one of these variants after being vaccinated, the vaccine still prevented against severe disease, hospitalization, and death. So, you know, the fact that these variants are out here is not a reason to say, I don't want to get the vaccine. The vaccine will still protect you against the most severe COVID disease and definitely death. So they are somewhat less effective, but still protective to us.
Will there be new vaccines introduced to deal with those variants specifically?
Yeah, time will tell. I know both Pfizer and Moderna specifically are doing research as we speak on this and developing. I'm not sure if they're developing new vaccines or modifying the current vaccines, but they are doing additional research on these new variants to see down the road, will we need a different vaccine? Will we need a booster? And again, we're learning more about variants. I mean, we speak of these three common variants, but we have to assume that there are probably other variants that are out there. So we'll learn more about that soon.
Here's a question that you hear fairly often as well. I've gotten my first shot of Moderna, and you could say the same for Pfizer, but I haven't gotten my second shot. Am I protected?
Yes, partially. And we're also learning more data about this. So Pfizer quoted in their clinical trials that after the first vaccine dose, that people were about 52% protective. There's new literature coming out. There was a group in Israel that looked at that Pfizer data and showed that if you extrapolate individuals that just got the first dose of Pfizer but were more than 14 days out, that the efficacy was on the order of 90%. So there is some partial protection after the first dose, but we still are recommending that for Pfizer and Moderna, you complete the vaccination series and get your second dose.
Let's take a phone call from Steve in Strasburg. Steve, you're on the air.
Good morning, Scott. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
One of my biggest concerns about the vaccines has always been the expected duration and durability of immunity from the vaccines. I understand that there's a human immune response with respect to the generation of antibodies. And I also understand from manufacturers' applications for emergency use that some of that immune response from antibodies could be measured in months. But I also understand that there's a longer-term immune response, with respect to T cell immunity. And there's been some projections about how long that T cell immunity might last and might have some more data available with Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, but maybe not enough about Johnson & Johnson. Can your guest speak to that question?
Thank you for your call, Steve. Dr. Curley, he has a few questions in there, but go ahead about the length of immunity, and then we'll talk a little bit about T cells.
Yeah, so a very good question, Steve. So we know that these vaccines are durable in the short term for sure. We don't have the long-term data yet, but you bring up two important topics because we've seen data showing that certain individuals' antibody levels after either contracting COVID-19 or getting the vaccine seem to wane over time. So you might see some decreasing levels of antibodies. Now, as Steve pointed out, that's not the entire picture because we also have something called T cell immunity, where our T cells help to fight off infection, and they play a role in preventing future infection after vaccination. So the participants of the three vaccine trials are being followed for approximately 2 years. And that is the data they're collecting. They're collecting that long-term data to see, hey, are individuals contracting COVID-19, you know, 3, 6, 9 months out from being originally vaccinated? They're also measuring both antibody levels as well as measures of T cell immunity. So that data will come. Both Pfizer and Moderna vaccine trials started in July of last year. So we're going to be hitting the 1 year mark pretty soon. And my hopes is that they're going to probably give an update at that time as to the results of some of that long-term immunity data, and that will factor in on whether we need to get booster vaccines or different vaccines in the future. So very good question, though.
To follow up on that, I mean, part of and the reason it is difficult to answer these questions is because, remember, we just had the first death a year ago, so we're still learning a lot about how these vaccines work. But I know one of the questions that you're asked probably most often, Dr. Curley, is will we have to get a shot on an annual basis?
Yes, and we just don't know yet. We're starting to hear a speculation that this is a definite possibility, but I don't think we're going to know until we get some of that long term data. Which again, we're probably not going to have at least the first year's worth of data until sometime this summer.
Well, I think that what a lot of people think about is how difficult it has been to get the supply that we need and get an appointment for a shot and, mass vaccination sites, that they're picturing that every year. Hopefully, if we do have to do this on an annual basis, it will mean just like a flu shot where you go to your family doctor or there are clinics set up. I mean, even at the farm show, they do flu shots, that it would be more like that than what we have now, right?
Yes, I would imagine so. Right now with the supply issues, I mean, that's one of the big things that WellSpan is working on right now is rolling out our community vaccination sites. But I do imagine that if we do need booster shots in the future or on an annual basis, that this will be something that you would get along with your flu shot at either your primary care physician or even at a commercial pharmacy.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to WITF Smart Talk. Our guest today, Dr. Eugene Curley, an infectious disease specialist at WellSpan Health. If you have a question, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Anne has a question, Dr. Curley. She wants to know why people who have had COVID get strong reactions to the vaccine. And usually it's that second shot.
Yeah, so I've heard that anecdotally, but what I can say is that the clinical trials for both Pfizer and Moderna both showed that people have increased expected symptoms after the second shot, and that is more than likely because the first shot primes your immune system, and so when you get the second shot, it recognizes, again, that foreign spike protein, and it can really generate a robust immune response and cause an increase in those expected symptoms. And again, those expected symptoms are signs that your immune system is working. So I don't think it's specific to people that have had COVID-19 in the past. They saw this in the clinical trials with most individuals that even had not had previous COVID-19.
We had a call that was recorded on voicemail from Laura, I think it is. Can we hear that, Joe?
Hi, this is Lauren calling from Hershey. My husband and I are in our 30s and 40s, and we are interested in getting vaccinated as soon as we are eligible. We have a 13-month-old daughter who has spent her entire life pretty much in isolation. We have been very careful. Only recently, in the last month or so, have we started to interact with her fully vaccinated grandparents. I'm just wondering, because children are not able to yet be vaccinated, what we should consider as our world starts to open up a little bit. If we have protection, but she does not, what should we keep in mind? Thank you.
Dr. Curley?
That's a very good question, and thank you for that question, Lauren. As we spoke about earlier, the CDC has released some guidance on fully vaccinated individuals and who they can interact with. I know that you, your husband and your child are not vaccinated yet, but one of the contingencies they had in that protocol was that fully vaccinated grandparents can visit with family members, one household only, of unvaccinated individuals. So again, the risk is extremely low, and the CDC has updated their guidance on that. It's difficult to say what additional safety protocols or when you can start to relax some of those safety protocols when, say, you and your family are out in public, because there's still circulating virus. There's still only a small percentage of the U.S. population that has been vaccinated to date. Once we see that a larger percentage of the population has been vaccinated, we anticipate that the CDC is going to update their guidelines on how people can interact and what safety protocols still need to be followed. So for the time being, I would recommend to continue doing what you're doing. My family, we're in a similar boat. I'm the only one vaccinated in my family, and we've essentially been in lockdown or quarantine for over a year now. We're gonna play it safe and wait for the population to get vaccinated and wait for some additional guidance from the CDC.
Let's take a call from Rebecca in Hershey. Rebecca, you're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Curley. My question is actually quite similar to the previous callers, but I recognize that the CDC guidance is changing, according to the circumstances as they change. But I guess I'm wondering also on the topic of children and the potential risk. I know we don't have any, longitudinal data to understand what the further complications could be, since typically children don't have any sort of serious, like life-threatening response to COVID. But I'm wondering if, let's say you had two vaccinated households and the children are obviously not vaccinated. If both households were to congregate and the children were to play, if they were wearing masks, would it be for the protection of the children amongst themselves? I mean, I'm just wondering how this might play out also when schools start to reopen, and what is the purpose of masking? Is it to protect the children from one another? If the teachers are vaccinated, I'm a little bit confused about that. Thank you so much.
Yeah, so that was one of the one of my critiques of their updated guidance about fully vaccinated individuals and how they can interact in private settings and with other households or even neighbors, is they really didn't address unvaccinated children. And so, that is an unknown right now. So we definitely know that for whatever reason, children don't develop as much severe disease as adults. But I always caution people that there are children that have died from COVID-19 and that get severe disease. So some of this is just a roll of the dice, and you just don't want to take a chance and have your child be the unlucky one. Getting back to one of the earlier topics, another point of masking with children is, again, we don't know if fully vaccinated people can also transmit the virus. So again, I'm fully vaccinated. So if I'm exposed to COVID-19, I'm probably not going to get sick. But can I potentially transmit it to someone who is not vaccinated? So that is why the updated guidance from the CDC is the way it is, and still cautions that, and if there are any exceptions to their new rules, that you still follow all safety protocols.
Let's take a call from Bill in Montrose. Bill, you're on the air.
Hey, Scott, good morning. I'm a regular listener. Learn a lot from your program. I want to get to the point because I know time's limited here.
Thank you.
We talked about the vaccine. Yes, the vaccine being so effective about in preventing deaths and reducing severe cases. My question is, we're hearing some cases about people who have very, very long-term effects from having COVID. And does this vaccine reduce that possibility of having to live for months with aches, pains, memory loss, and so on?
Good question.
Very good question. And the short of it is we don't know quite yet. So none of the clinical trials for Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, and Moderna really looked at long hauler symptoms or post-COVID complications. Again, we can make projections, or we always hate to make assumptions in scientific literature, but because these vaccines seem to be so effective, that hopefully a lot of the large majority of people that are vaccinated won't develop COVID-19 whatsoever. But if you're, no vaccine is 100% effective. So if you're unlucky, does it prevent post-COVID complication? Does it prevent long hauler symptoms? We just don't know yet, unfortunately.
Let's take another call from David in Mechanicsburg. David, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call this morning. I have an individual in my family that had Lyme disease. They had Lyme disease for about a year before it was treated, and they've had significant long-term issues caused by that Lyme disease, and now they're concerned about getting the vaccine and how that would interact with that other disease. And I'll take my answer offline. Thank you.
All right, David. Thanks. Dr. Curley?
Yes. So there's no contraindication for people with Lyme disease or even chronic symptoms from Lyme disease to get the COVID-19 vaccination. The vaccine should not have any effect on any of those chronic symptoms or their previous diagnosis. So I would encourage that individual that when they are eligible to get the vaccine.
Dr. Curley, we've gotten several emails from listeners wanted to talk about what you had mentioned earlier, but the general consensus from several of these vaccines is that mistrust in the pharmaceutical companies, the hesitancy to get vaccinated. We've had some examples of talking about the price gouging and things like that. If you would, will you address, for those people who just have a mistrust of pharmaceutical companies?
Yes. So again, these pharmaceutical companies have been quite transparent with the data from these clinical trials. You can easily Google the results of these clinical trials. They have what are termed fact sheets. If you just Google Pfizer fact sheet, they have ones for patients, one for healthcare providers that has all of the data there. And again, after these clinical trials, the FDA, ACIP, CDC, they go through a very rigorous vetting process. These vaccines, overwhelmingly, the data shows that they're very effective and they're very, very safe. I have a lot of trust in the science. I'll be very honest with everyone that's listening right now. I was very hesitant about receiving the vaccine before I was able to read the data and really comb through it and go through it. If you're not one that can easily interpret some of this data, I just encourage everyone to talk with their primary care physician, continue to ask questions, bring these topics up. As providers, we shouldn't run from this conversation. I like to address it head on, make sure I answer all of my patients' concerns, and then hopefully we can curb some of this hesitancy and I'll get vaccinated.
Dr. Eugene Curley, thank you very much for being with us. Dr. Curley is the infectious disease specialist at WellSpan Health. Thank you very much. And for those who didn't get their answers, their questions answered, we'll try to get those answered for you. Dr. Curley, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a good day.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.